Hi, Marcia.
Hi there.
How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Yeah, really good, thanks. Really good. Firstly, thanks, so much for joining me today on the podcast. So look, just let's get straight into it. Firstly, I'd like to, do a brief introduction for you. So I'm joined today by Dr. Marcia Goddard, so neuroscientist and a specialist in the field of diversity, inclusion, company culture, all of those types of things. So as I say, firstly, really appreciate you taking the time out today, Marcia.
Happy to be here.
So look, we're talking today specifically about company culture. And I think the overarching topic that we really wanted to get into conversation about is, is creating and nurturing company culture, is there a science behind that? Or is this kind of just an organic process, an organic thing that takes on its own life form and kind of develops on its own? So look, kicking off, let's talk about that, Marcia. What are your kind of what are your thoughts on that particular topic?
It's a good question. I mean, in practice, it is an organic process, isn't it? I've never really met anyone that started a company and said, I am going to put all my focus into creating the perfect company culture. So what you tend to do in the beginning when you're a startup, especially in the early stages, is that you're going to focus on on revenue, and that makes sense because you have to make money. But then once the company becomes profitable and you hire more people, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, we're with 100 people now, and then the culture is already there. So it doesn't even matter if you focused on it or if you've written it down; it's going to be there. Whenever you put people together in a room, then stuff is going to happen, and that stuff. That forms your company culture.
So with that in mind, Marcia, when is the perfect time to start thinking about creating and shaping company culture? I suppose the obvious answer would be before the company's even created. It's like, day one, greenfield, site. But in regards to developing that strategy, when is the ideal kind of time to kick off that process?
I mean, it's always good right from the beginning when you start hiring people to think about the type of people that you would want in your company. Not just look at that from a functional perspective, which is what you tend to do in the beginning, but also actually look at what type of person is it. But what I always say is when you don't fit at the lunch table anymore together, then it's really time to start thinking about it a bit more strategically. So that's like between 25 and 50 people. It's a rough estimate. There's no hard science behind this, obviously. But what I notice is that then those dynamics start to have an influence.
So I'm assuming that, the first kind of, let's say a startup that's, there's maybe one, two founders, and they're ready to kind of do their first phase of growth, their first like two, three, four, five hires, whatever that looks like. Those hires are pretty pivotal, I'm assuming, to the evolution of that company culture and the
Absolutely.
direction that that culture is going to go. You've probably seen a few scenarios where, those hires, and they could be great hires and have an amazing impact on the company and on revenue and profits, but the company that the revenue and profits, I'm assuming, is they're not always directly linked to the company culture. You can be creating an awful lot of money over here. The company culture might not always be following the same trajectory of success in, over here. Is
Absolutely.
that fair to say?
Absolutely. I mean, culture is something that doesn't really, it doesn't have that much of an impact in the short run. In the short run, it's like if you're going to be profitable, then you feel like you're doing great. In the long run, what you want a healthy company culture so that your people are well. And when your people are well, then in the long run, they're going to keep performing. If you don't do that, then which is also like you can also make the decision to not do that and to focus on really like the hard KPIs and the hard like the profit. It's a different type of person. Then you will get people in your company that will work there for 2 to 3 years. Then they'll just burn out pretty much, and you would have to replace them, which is something that happens in companies. And I'm not absolutely not saying that that is a bad thing. I would do it differently, but that's because I specialize in how to build those healthy cultures. But it's just a decision that people have to make.
No, that's a really good point. And in that same vein as well. So is there any specific advice you'd maybe give to founders? So there, an individual founder, two, three co-founders, whatever it may be, that are thinking, look, you know what? Revenue, profits, our product to that side. We just want to sit down and we just really want to plan, the evolution of our company culture, what we want that to look like, where we want that to go. Are there any particular steps that you'd maybe advise that founder or those co-founders to take before they start recruiting those first 5, 10, 15 hires, for example?
Yeah, this is going to sound odd, but I've noticed in practice that it doesn't happen. Hire somebody for HR in the beginning.
Right.
HR is usually something that comes later, because first you have sales and you have finance, and then usually somebody from the finance team will also do HR, which is then the administrative processes.
Yeah.
But get somebody in with people skills who understands how culture works, who understands, you know, how people operate, who understands what you need from a behavioral perspective, and let them do it. Because this is a huge, gross generalization, but in general, entrepreneurs are not always the best people.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what I mean? So if you hire somebody to do that for you, then you can facilitate that healthy growth right from the beginning.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. One of the things that I hear a lot of, and I'm sure you do as well, and many of the people listening to this probably also do, is culture fit when we talk about the hiring process. And I've got my own opinions on this. I'd be really keen to understand some of yours. But when you hear even the phrase culture fit in the hiring or talent attraction process, what's the first thing that kind of springs to mind for you?
Bias.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's definitely culture fit is a big thing, right? Everybody wants to hire, like it's hire for attitude, train for skills. And what they mean is you need to fit into the culture.
Yeah.
But it would be much better in my perspective to look at it from the perspective of cultural add. So what is a new hire going to bring to the company that you don't have yet? What is their added value? Because if you look for culture fit, then you activate your bias. And the strongest bias would be similarity bias. We tend to want to be around people that look like us, that act like us, with which we have something in common. But that's not very great for innovation. That literally kills innovation, because innovation is about thinking differently. So you need people who think differently, who have different perspectives.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And yeah, I'm glad actually, because it's a very, very similar thought to the thought that I had, certainly around the whole bias topic that you brought up there. So in regards to, you may have hired certain types of people, they're performing really well, you feel like they're fitting in really well into your organization, into the culture that you're looking to develop. In regards to making sure you're not going down the road that you mentioned there, the whole kind of the clone model, more. Are there exercises that you can go and think, okay, brilliant. So we hired this person here. They're doing that role. They're doing a great job. But in regards to thinking, okay, what is this person great at? What is all the value they're adding? But maybe what's missing over here? What are the holes that we do need to fill? Are there any good exercises you can go on to start thinking about what we have that's great, but what we don't have, and maybe what we do need to look at in the hiring process?
Yeah, for that, it really helps. What I've been doing for the past years is quantifying organizational cultures. And that means that I quantify it in terms of behavior, so that you know which behaviors do I have in my company and which ones do I need. So to give you a really concrete example, I worked with a large recruitment agency and I quantified their culture, and it was a culture of risk taking.
Okay.
So one of the core elements of the culture was that people were tempted to take risks, to try new things, to experiment, which is fantastic because that allowed them to grow. But what you want on your team, though, is to have risk taking on a spectrum. So if you know risk taking is one of these behaviors, you can use, for example, an assessment or a behavioral interview and something like that to really assess how much risk taking do we have now on the team.
Yeah.
And then decide if maybe at some point you're going to want to hire somebody who is a little bit less risk-taking on the spectrum, because otherwise you're going to get a bunch of cowboys who are going to start taking unnecessary or irresponsible risks. That's also not what you want. So it's about balance.
Yeah.
And you can only create that balance if you know what type of behaviors you have and which ones you don't have yet.
Okay. So with that in mind, are you quite a big advocate of behavioral assessments, just to make sure you've got a formalized platform for analyzing those personality traits?
I think that definitely helps. It's not the holy grail, absolutely not, because it's not 100% predictive of workflow behavior. But if you combine different things, behavioral interviews with a cognitive assessment or personality assessment or whatever it is that you want to use. I don't like cognitive assessments, to be honest. I'm much more in favor of personality or competencies. But if you combine these different data points and you add them together, and then preferably do that anonymously so that you don't know who you're dealing with when you're assessing these skills, then I think you get to the best hires based on objective criteria. Because as much as we would love to be, we are not objective at all when we make decisions.
Absolutely. So wherever you possibly can, and in all these processes, I suppose the overarching thing is just reducing, I think taking out altogether is probably a step too far, but reducing the bias wherever you possibly can, basically.
Yeah. We call it bias mitigation.
Right. Okay. Like it. So sort of moving in a slightly different direction, you know, what one of the things that that I'm quite, you know, keen to understand your thoughts on is that, you know, are there some companies out there that you think are in danger of maybe kind of portraying the company culture, the mission, the values they kind of want to have, but maybe don't have right now, but they're kind of almost outwardly projecting who they want to be as opposed to who they are. Is that something you've seen, or you've got any thoughts on that topic?
Many. Right. Yeah, you ask, are there some companies? I think it's not some, it's almost all of them. And I understand why. I do not think that there are bad intentions behind it, because people tend to, you know, showcase their company as they aspire to be. I think it only becomes problematic if the gap between like your talk and your walk is too big, because then you're not going to attract the right candidates, and that's going to become problematic. I mean, if you look at Enron, the company, the horrible company from the US that failed, and was, most people will know about it. Their company values were respect, integrity, communication, and excellence.
Yeah.
That gap is too large. That's not going to work. So you want to attract the right people. And to do that, you need to be, it's good to have to be aspirational in your values and in what you portray your culture to be, but it has to have a link to reality as well, because otherwise you're going to say you're a purpose-driven company, but really you're profit-oriented. Then you're going to get purpose-driven people in your company who then once they're in have to work on delivering profit. That's not going to work. That's not what they want. So that's not good for your company. It's not good for them. It's not good for anybody.
And what about, so with an example like that, so a profit-driven company that maybe has started to take stock and they're thinking, look, okay, let's just be really honest with ourselves. We're a profit-driven company, but we want to be values, mission, purpose-driven. We want to be this type of company, or in a slightly, you know, different road, we're not diverse enough as an organization, and we're actually reflecting on this a lot, and we know we're not, you know, we haven't got a diverse workforce, but we actually want to start making some strides towards being an organization that is doing more to make sure our workforce is more diverse. You know, what advice maybe would you give to companies that are in that stage, because they might feel a bit lost sometimes in regards to their strategy around culture, you know, evolution and talent attraction.
Yeah. So I think it's all about the intention. If your intention is to check a box because Black Lives Matter is here and you feel you have to, then please don't do it, because it's not going to be effective and it's not going to help you. It's not going to help you at all. But it is absolutely okay to say, you know, we want to move towards being a more diverse organization. So what I would say is don't showcase your diversity if you don't have it yet. I understand why companies do that, because they want underrepresented groups to recognize themselves in it and then hopefully, you know, get them to apply for a job so that they actually can become more diverse. But if you have like two women and then one person from an underrepresented group working in your company, don't make them the center of your employer branding. So instead, what you can do is just, you know, kind of let them talk on camera, if possible, about their experiences working at a company that actually isn't diverse yet, but is taking real steps to get there. And then again, it's about also walking your talk.
Yeah. Okay. Some really good advice there. Okay. And so something, again, I was really keen to talk to you about was inclusivity, and I suppose how companies are communicating their culture. A lot of the time they're doing this via talent attraction efforts. You know, that's when we often get exposed to, you know, how companies communicate company culture. But you know, I'd really like to hear your thoughts about how organizations can make sure maybe they're being inclusive in the way they communicate culture, the way they communicate, anything really about attracting talent into their organization. Have you got any thoughts on the inclusivity topic?
Yeah, I think, you know, for one, job descriptions to me are not a very good way of portraying your company culture to begin with, and also not your values, because there really isn't that much room to elaborate on what they mean, what your values mean, what your culture really is. And that makes it, well, that kind of makes it sort of a meaningless set of words on paper that are open to many, many interpretations, and you'll never know how people reading it will interpret it. So that's why I like technologies such as voice, because it allows people to actually have a look inside the company. And obviously, you know, you can still be less than truthful about your culture on video, and you can use it purely as a marketing tool. But if you're serious about showcasing who you are as a company, then I think those types of technologies are a great way to do so, because they add something, they add context. And if you add more context, it becomes easier for people to understand.
Yeah. And in that same vein, I think, you know, you mentioned, you know, at the start of the conversation, but it's kind of looking at things, and it's that kind of that people like me psychology, I think, a lot of the time, isn't it? It's like, you know, would I fit into that place, into that organization, into that team? Do I align to that mission, values, purpose? And yeah, it's an interesting topic, but no, okay, yeah, thanks. So in sectors such as technology, there are, you know, there are so many companies that are, you know, that they often don't appeal to underrepresented communities, because probably going back to that topic we were speaking about just then, you know, the whole people like me thing, you know, there, yeah. Technology is one of probably, I wouldn't say the worst offenders, because they're not offenders. They're not offenders by any means at all. But from outwardly kind of looking in, you know, it's an underrepresented industry. And in regards to kind of leveling the playing field, in regards to having more diverse workforces in sectors such as technology, where it, you know, we need to get to a more level playing field, you know, are there any kind of, is there any advice that you can give to leaders of organizations in tech or any other industry that they're kind of unsure where to look in regards to hiring a more diverse workforce?
Yeah, I think hiring people in tech in general is really difficult, isn't it? Because there aren't enough people in tech. And I think, you know, the flip side of that is that in general, tech companies tend to be rather on the diverse side, because people will come from everywhere. Yeah. But, you know, to make it a conscious decision, I think it would help to speak to people from underrepresented groups to find out what their needs are, what their wishes are when they work at a company, because it has an impact on everything. For example, compensation and benefits packages. You can go lots of different directions there. But if you assume that somebody, just the discussion of salary versus equity, for example, it's just the first thing that popped into my mind. Yeah. Some people will want a higher base salary. Some people will want more equity. And there are common threads within groups. So if you're just going to, if you're about to buy a house, you're a young person, you have a family, you're about to buy a house, you would want a higher base salary.
Yeah.
If you're a more senior person, you would probably want more equity. This is just a random example. But finding out what the groups that you would like to hire need in terms of compensation and benefits, or in terms of educational needs, or in terms of leave, things like that. If you have a picture of that, then you can adapt your processes to actually attract them. That would be step one. The second is they also have to feel like they belong.
Yeah.
And that's why when it comes to diversity and inclusion, I don't really focus in my own work. I don't focus that much on diversity. I focus more on inclusion.
Yeah.
Because you have to create an inclusive environment. Otherwise, you know, you could be really good at attracting a diverse group of people, but they're going to leave straight out the back door again. Yeah. That's why inclusion matters so much. So, you know, if I have to give one piece of advice to any, not just tech, but I guess anybody who wants to work on this, it would be to prioritize bias mitigation and inclusion in your organization. And that's not just recruitment, because that's where a lot of talk is, you know, bias free recruitment, things like that, but it's everywhere. It's bias in decision making.
Yeah, no, that's great and really thought-provoking as well. So in regards to, you know, doing more work around engaging with those communities and trying to start connecting some of those dots in regards to, well, you know, before we actually go and, you know, put some plans in place to hire a more diverse workforce, what do people actually want? And let's start connecting some of those dots. You know, let's say there were, you know, business leaders or, you know, HR employer brand culture leaders that thinking, look, we're passionate about this and we want to start this journey. So, okay, we've heard that we need to engage with communities and start, you know, talking to communities and listening to people and talk. Again, that there's still a bit of a road to go there. It's like, okay, fine, I get that, but where do I start? What's the road I go down to actually start engaging with, you know, a community to ask a set of questions? Where would you say, you know, what is the starting point if a company's passionate about doing this?
Yeah, I think the starting point isn't to go directly to those communities now that we're talking about this. It's also to educate yourself first, because one of the things that is really kind of, it's not insulting, but what's not fair to these underrepresented groups is that now they get a lot of questions about what do you want? Tell me what you want. When there is a lot of stuff out there that organizations can read themselves to find out more about, you know, the Black experience, for example. So do that first. Yeah. Educate yourself first. Two, I mean, if I was the CHRO of any company, I would go to my peers in the C-level first and say, are you sure you want this? Yeah. Because it will mean that you are going to have to make room for people. Like, there has to be a place at the table for them. And that means that you have to do that as well, not just at the entry level, but also at the upper level. So get their buy-in, get their sponsorship. And then once you have that, you're educated yourself, you know that everybody is on board. Then there are many groups out there that you can just go to have a conversation about, you know, about these groups themselves. So then it would be time to reach out to them. And then you can just adapt your entire business strategy, recruitment, performance management, things like that, to facilitate a career path for these people inside the company.
Yeah, and I think really importantly, what you've leaned on there is that if you don't have that top-down buy-in, you know, not just to this particular topic, but pretty much any in the culture argument, it's a non-starter, isn't it? So ensuring you've got that kind of board down buy-in is critical, I suppose, isn't it?
Absolutely. Culture, as much as I would like it to be different, culture is very hierarchical.
Yeah.
It starts from the top. And it starts with, we talked about startups, you know, the people who start the company, they're the ones who decide what the culture is going to be. And it's not a conscious process, but they have a huge impact. Yeah. So yeah, the C-level or whoever, whatever your level is in the company, they have to be on board with it. And they have to lead by example as well.
Fantastic. Well, Marcia, as always, it's been really, really good talking to you. Thank you so much for taking the time out. And I look forward to catching up with you again soon. Just a quick one for anybody listening to this episode. I know that you do some kind of consultative kind of work around culture, diversity, inclusion. So if anybody's got any questions for you, or are they okay to kind of field them with you? Is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely. They can find me on LinkedIn. I also recently launched my website, brainmattersconsulting.com. So feel free to contact me anytime.
Awesome. Thanks so much. And look forward to speaking again soon.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye, Marcia.
Bye.